Good evening. Is there anyone here for the first time? Welcome. Welcome. I'm going to talk a little about the precepts, the Buddhist precepts tonight. These are the ethical guidelines that the Buddha gave us. And a few things pointed me in this direction. I gave the meditation instruction that we do once a month a couple of months ago on a Saturday, and kind of a seasoned sitter was in the group who, you know, just wanted to brush up on things. And afterwards he said that he always found the precepts sort of the most boring part of Buddhism. That he never could really get into it. And that my explanation of them all at that meditation instruction hadn't really changed his opinion on me. So I figured I had to work on my delivery. And of course we get a lot of opportunity to study the precepts at Zen Center, not the least of which is our monthly precept ceremony that we do here on the full moon. And so we did that just a couple weeks ago, so that's sort of fresh in my mind. And of course, with all of our rites of passage ceremonies at the Zendo, the precepts really are at the core of Jukai ceremonies, of ordination ceremonies, of marriages, and then the transmission ceremony that I just went through in January. So the precepts have been taking their place on the front burner of my thoughts and practice over these last couple of months. And then I want to throw in, of course, we've all been working very hard studying the mind-only school of Buddhism with Kokyo, the Yogacara school. And a friend of mine was really struggling. He doesn't practice here, but he practices elsewhere. He was really struggling with the Yogacara concepts. And he said something that it was kind of like the question that we've brought up. You know, in our hard study of these complicated concepts, where can we find compassion between the lines of all of those concepts? And how do we actually practice with some of the concepts? And I'll touch on that a little bit too, because I think looking at the precepts and our mind always gives us opportunity to practice. Now, I looked in Suzuki Roshi for some guidance on how to present the precepts, and lo and behold, right in the prologue, the kind of chapter before chapter one talks about the precepts and talks about what I think is a quick and dirty version of the mind-only Yogacara school. So it was very rich, and I think everyone who reads Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, though it's a slim little volume, realizes how dense, how full every chapter is, and how much there is in every chapter. Not that it's difficult to read, quite the opposite. But he's able to pack a lot in a very simple, straightforward way that has encouraged practice here in this country for the last 60 years. So I felt on pretty good ground turning there first. And as he's trying to, the book is titled, of course, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And he sort of gives a definition of that, starting out, people say that practicing Zen is difficult. For Zen students, the most important thing is not to be dualistic. Our original mind includes everything within itself. It is always rich and sufficient within itself. You should not lose your self-sufficient state of mind. This does not mean a closed mind, but actually an empty mind and a ready mind. If your mind is empty, it is always ready for anything. It is open to everything. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. So he uses a lot of synonyms here for beginner's mind, original mind, self-sufficient mind, empty mind, ready mind. I've seen the term original mind in lots of different writing in Buddhist literature, and this is probably a pretty good definition of it that I'll try to remember and work with when I see that phrase, original mind. It's an empty mind that's ready for anything. I like to think of it as a mind that you know is ready. It's not rejecting things that come to it. It's receptive. We've certainly talked about Dogen's receptive mind, his fascicle on where we talked about the receptivity of the mind. So this is a receptive mind, a mind that's not rejecting anything, a mind that really is okay with what's happening right here and right now in this moment. It's not wishing for something different in this moment. It's not wishing for another moment. It's just open and ready and receptive. Suzuki goes on to say, if you discriminate too much, you know, picking and choosing, wanting something different in this moment, if you discriminate too much, you limit yourself. If you are too demanding or greedy, your mind is not rich and self-sufficient. And this is where he starts in on the precepts. If you lose your original self-sufficient mind, we will lose all precepts. So this is a good tie-in with the Yogacara mind-only idea. You know, where all of our experience, all the things that have come to us, all the things we've inherited are in this storehouse consciousness part of the brain. These have been called seeds, bijas, little seeds. And the part of the brain that really kind of defines the self, you know, the seventh consciousness, really just picks and chooses certain parts of those, of all the possible experiences that are laid down in that eighth consciousness. It just picks certain ones, saying, these are the ones I like, these are the ones I don't like. These likes and dislikes define me. And so you can see where he says that this mind that picks and chooses really is a mind that's limiting. It's not open to all the possible choices. It's not holding all the possible choices evenly. It's not balancing out the this's and the that's, embracing them all. But it's really saying, you know, I like these, I don't like these, and that's what defines me. So this discriminating mind is a limiting mind. It limits our choices. In the previous chapter, he called this original mind the self-sufficient mind, the beginner's mind, also the non-dual mind, the mind that really does hold each one of these seeds, each one of these experiences equally, and is not rejecting, is integrating all of the choices that are available to us. This is that receptive mind. And so there's been a lot of Zen terms that have been thrown out just in these first few chapters or first few paragraphs of Zen mind, beginner's mind, the ideas of original mind and non-duality. When precepts are studied, it's frequently presented with a short poem in the Dhammapada, one of Buddha's earliest teachings. So Buddha is teaching from very early on ethical teachings, how to get along, how can the monks get along, how can one person get along with another. That's what the precepts guide us in. And of course, I always go to a place of another term, intimacy. The precepts really bring two pieces together, really bring two people together, really bring two nations together manifest the unity, the connectedness, the interconnectedness of everything. So so that's why the precepts have been exciting for me, because I think we really have that experience. I think when we can think about times that we have just settled in to this moment, not rejecting this or that, not rejecting him or her. I think that's an experience for me of really feeling connected with my environment and with the people in my environment. So the precepts bring me directly to that really settled, comfortable place. And that's why I wanted to work on this delivery, hoping that other people would look at the precepts and study them with that heart and mind. So this early teaching of Buddha in the Dhammapada is pretty simple. Practice good, avoid evil, and purify the mind. So in the beginning, it really says, take a look at your world, especially if you feel like you're in a mind or a world where you can say this is good and this is evil, and and what should I do? You know, which angel is on each shoulder, the angel and the devil on each shoulder? You know, which direction should I go in? So Buddha really acknowledges that that in our relative world, the world that we, you know, wake up in and put our shoes on in, really does have these poles that we can choose from. And he gives us a little direction. I mean, he says, you know, aim for one, avoid the other. And then he, to really kind of do that practice, he encourages us to purify the mind. And this idea of purity is another term that comes up a lot in Buddhist writings. And that's a code word for non-duality. That's a code word for really holding those opposites with compassion, holding them equally, embracing both sides, not rejecting one or the other, not pulling one too closely and the other one pushed away. So if we can think of the times that we're really sure about which direction to go in, about which where the good is and I want to avoid where the evil is, when we're really stuck, we might think of that as a pretty concrete idea in our mind, kind of like, you know, if we've been digging up the back there where we had bamboo that was just going everywhere. So Rain and many others here in this room have dug it up, and it continued to rain. So now it is just this big mud hole. But you know, that mud hole is going to get pretty hard. We're not going to be able to really work that ground for quite a while. So think of that fixed idea as really being that kind of concrete mud ball landing someplace in our mind. And the Buddha says, you know, purify your mind. Buddha says, you know, that pretty good idea that you think you have isn't really the way to go. It you might think of it, no matter how good an idea of it is, you might think of that as a pretty stuck, hard clod that that really isn't the definition of purity. So this idea of purifying the mind is really saying, you know, take a good hard look before you move in one direction or another, before, you know, this mind directs an action towards one way or another. See if you can't hold things a little more lightly. Hold those hard places a little more lightly. Hold things a little more loosely. Embrace both sides and try that approach before you make your movement. So that's Buddha's first instruction. You know, before he sets out on, he's giving us 10 precepts to follow, to work with. Before he says anything about that, he says, you know, you're going to find, you're going to come up with good ideas. You're going to discard bad ideas. But before you make any movement, see if you can't hold on to those ideas a little less tightly. Look at both of them carefully, and before you launch out. And of course, you know, immediately when we take that approach, we're a lot closer to both choices, especially the one that we've rejected. We've immediately, you know, started having a real relationship with that idea that really seemed off base, And we're not so much in love with that part of the brain that has held on so tightly to the other choice. So immediately we've got some equanimity, and we've got a little more of an intimate relationship with all the choices before us. And I think that's a good way to start out practicing the precepts, looking at killing, looking at supporting life, looking at respecting the things of ourselves and others, and not wanting to steal them. These are just, two ways of looking at the first two precepts that the Buddha prescribed for us. Looking at anger, looking at what you think of praising yourself, looking at your speech, looking at what you say about others, looking about how true or false your speech is. Those are a few of the ways that the Buddha says, take a look at all those aspects of how you live in the world, and see if working with that can't bring you a little closer to the people around you, to the environment around you. When we embrace the precepts, when we say that the precepts look like a pretty good path to follow in this world, after we've studied Buddhism for a while and we start becoming familiar with the precepts and practicing them, and we really want to take that vow to practice with the precepts and have the ceremony, Jukai, or ordination, along with an intensive investigation of these precepts, we start sewing robes. Here's the big wraparound robe, the okesa, and a lot of people in here are wearing the more portable robe that you can actually walk out in the world in, the ones, the bib-like ones around the neck. They're all based on, pieces of cloth that have been sewn together. And what a great idea, what a great symbol or a manifestation of purifying the mind or non-duality. I mean, we're actually taking pieces of cloth, one here and one there, and one here and one there and one there. I mean, many, many pieces of cloth, and we're actually putting them together into one thing. And so this, I can think of as many pieces, and I can think of as one big piece, and I can hold that idea in my head at the same time. It's not a trick. The non-dual mind is not something that's acquired only in deep meditation, or something that only certain kinds of people can hold that idea, because they've got a certain calmness or a certain innate wisdom. It really is something that we can think of. I can think of this as many pieces and one big piece all at the same time. And then, of course, when it becomes Buddha's robe in any of the forms that it takes on our bodies, it's really transformed. And that's what the purity, practicing to purify the mind really does. It really transforms it into something completely different. You're totally out of the realm of this or that, right and wrong. Transformed into something pretty special. And anything that we take on with that practice of purification really has the opportunity to take to be transformed, to be something special. You can sit around the Thanksgiving table and look at all the people in your life, all of your family, and you can say, you know, I can hold both sides here. I can hold all of those arguments with my parents, and I just know that I'm going to love my parents for the rest of my life. I can hold everything about my significant other, the good and the bad, and I'm going to have no trouble jumping in bed with him. It is not a special state at all to really work with purifying the mind, to really transform very polar opposites into, you know, one thing that's pretty special. It's something that we do time and time again every day. And Buddha says, really to keep that mind or that practice right on the front burner. And what that does is also when we can really stop struggling, you know, shall I go this way? Shall I go this way? Shall I get a divorce? Shall I not talk to my parents again? When I'm really working with that, and I can transform moments like that, that really is the mind and heart of compassion. And Suzuki backs that up. All self-centered thoughts limit this vast mind. When we have no thought of achievement, no thought of self, we are true beginners. Then we can really learn something. The beginner's mind, this original mind, is the mind of compassion. And when our mind is compassionate, it is boundless. Dogen Zenji, the founder of this school of Buddhism, always emphasized how important it is to resume our boundless original mind. Then we are always true to ourselves. We're in sympathy with all beings, and we can actually practice. So, that's why this practice has so much going for it. That's why there's so much in these first few paragraphs, because it takes us from, you know, this wrestling match of this moment, you know, the this or the that of this moment, all the way to transformation and compassion in just a few easy steps. Although, as Suzuki says, So the most difficult thing is to keep your beginner's mind. So you can just tell yourself that yes, it's Suzuki says it's the most difficult thing, but he tells you how to do it in just a few short paragraphs. So it's worth giving a try. Just written down a few examples. They're pretty easy ones. I could go into more detail about Thanksgiving at my house, but but I'll choose the easier example. I was in my car at that crazy River Street Highway 1 exit, you know, coming from Costco, trying to get onto River Street and then to Highway 1, and you know, you've got this big line of cars, you know, trying to go through three lanes to turn left onto Highway 1, and it's just impossible. And the person in front of me wasn't budging. And so I was very much in our relative world, and I had a lot of opinions about the person in front of me. And then I remembered when I was that first person in line, and I wanted to go just the place he was wanting to go, and how I was holding up everybody behind me. So immediately, maybe because I thought of myself, I was able to hold both options at once. I was able to, you know, really want to get across the street, and I was really able to remember the mind of, I can't go anywhere. I really have to just sit here. And just that memory was enough to, you know, all of my energy was this way for the longest time, with a lot of harboring ill will, that eighth precept, that I was, so all of my energy was here. And when I, you know, had that memory of me being in the same situation, I was immediately, you know, kind of right here, and feeling a whole lot closer to the person ahead of me, a lot less, you know, in opposition to that frame of mind. And it's a very visceral experience to just stop in traffic and not have that motion to go forward. It's pretty nice when you can just sit straight up like we do in Zazen. Suzuki, in other places in the book, talks about Zazen, this upright posture, not wanting to crowd that person forward, not wanting to lean back so you can give them a good kick, but just being upright and not wanting to move in your life. He talks about, you know, that's how we practice the precepts. When thoughts arise in our Zazen, and I think a lot of us had that experience tonight, when thoughts arise and you can just say, not now, and let that thought go and come back to this posture and just this breath, that's being in accord. That's why Buddha gave us this practice of the precepts, just to be in accord with this moment, with this body, with this mind, and we can have that that experience for 40 minutes on the cushion whenever we want. And we can have it every time, you know, we're right there at that intersection. It's not rare. This practice of purifying the mind, of being upright in this body, is not rare. It's not special. It's transformative, but it's not special. And just to cap off in the last couple of minutes with another example of this mind is is a koan that we've looked at before. It was brought up in a lecture here by, I can't remember who talked about it, but it's Yunmen's body that's exposed in the golden wind. A monk asked Yunmen, "How is it when the tree withers and the leaves fall?" And Yunmen said, "Body exposed in the golden wind." I think that's a great image. And then Yunmen, the commentary, not Yunmen, but the commentary a few paragraphs later says, you know, be careful that you're not carried away with emotion when you're looking at this koan. But I have to say that just imagining a body exposed, my body exposed in a golden wind, I think really pulled me right in. And so what do we think about a withering tree with falling leaves? Is that where we want to be? Is that, would we want something different in our lives? Would we want to change something if we had the mind of withering or exfoliation? Yunmen says, just open your heart. Don't be afraid. Dare to be vulnerable. Dare to be touched on all sides, and not reject anything. And experience the golden wind of your life. And this is Suzuki again, saying that this original mind, this mind that holds everything, is rich and boundless. So we've got a couple of minutes. Any thoughts about stepping into this or that, stepping this way or that way? Any thoughts about the times that you just sat still and felt a little more grounded and a little more intimate? Maybe River.
Thank you. So before we make a decision, is we should consider both options, and is that what it's saying? Keep both abreast as a possibility, not generally label them good or evil, or is that how it's saying to make a decision?
Well, just kind of imagine what that mind would be. That is very comfortable experiencing the golden wind, not afraid of this or that. What kind of decision, you know, what kind of action would come out of that mind? And I think there's lots of ways to think about that. One is what kind of practices do you do in your life to sort of keep that on the front burner? We have to admit that Suzuki said it's the hardest thing. And So how do we practice to keep that heart and mind, you know, at least within arm's reach, or at least close enough that when you when all hell breaks loose, you can come up with a quick apology. So I think what you've said is true. You know, how do you keep that heart and mind available to make a skillful action, and then to also, you know, to make sure that your heart is big enough that you can love yourself that is causing, you know, chaos. So take that on. Give it a whirl. Marianne.
I'm just thinking about how the Ten Commandments, from being raised Catholic and also knowing the precepts, that is more punishment. You know, you keep them because you don't want to go to hell and have to purgatory, or you don't want to have to have karma. But what I'm hearing is that it's looked at more like there's no difference between me and this other person. That we're the same. That we're not separate. And I think at moments I can remember that. But that sense of, I gotta protect myself, I gotta get. It's a different approach, you know. It's almost like punishment might be better, but you know, I think it's more pure to think that, you know, I'm this person, and stealing from someone or saying bad things about someone really doesn't make sense if you're really doing it to yourself. But at least, but I do feel very separate.
Well, one technique. We look at the precepts all the time, and one technique that we've tried is we're encouraged to really take on not stealing or not lying. Just try it. You're kind of a dare, and see how far that gets you. And that too is a really good practice for really trying to say, okay, how can I take on, you know, these precepts so that they're really meaningful and that really expresses the Buddha's, you know, first thoughts of being in accord. Purifying the mind, but they are written down in lots of places. A disciple of Buddha doesn't take life. A disciple of Buddha doesn't take what isn't given. A disciple of Buddha doesn't harbor ill will. It's written down a lot, and so you know, try that. And then see how it goes. You see that I can't do that all the time either. And so you have to find this way of embracing all possibilities, because there's very few clear choices in our lives. And just trying to decide, am I stealing this, or you know, these cookies were out here for people to take, and nobody really offered it to me, but you know, I think they're for everybody. Even trying to decide whether it's a precept or not is so difficult, and so that's why I think. I think very early on, he says, start off with first, you know, just trying to embrace both sides, just really try to get an equanimous look at the situation.
Is it sort of like, you know, destructive emotions blind you, you know, your view? You're less aware of what's real and what the truth is. So I'm wondering if by following the precepts, that brings you closer to reality, and it's just sort of a guideline to get to reality rather than, you know, you're bad if you do something. You know, I've got all this thousand things that I'm drenched in.
Yeah, and you have to even step back from that destructive frame of mind. See if that can be a mindfulness bell to, I'm already firmly on one side of this equation, and I think actually when you can just say that, you know, right away is a transformative moment, and already, you know, there's a compassionate heart that's galloping forward. So actually, I think we've hit the last minute here, and I invite people to come on inside for cookies, and we can carry on. The reason that the precepts are taught over and over again is it's really about our lives, and it's boundless, the way Suzuki talked about it. It really is rich. So I look forward to talking more inside. May the merit of looking at this subject keep us open to all possibilities and keep our hearts open. Being our numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be clean.